You're listening to Counterculture on RCR.
Reality Check Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio. And as promised, Marty is joining me now for Media Matters for another week. And we've survived the budget, Marty.
Yep. Good. Good. How are you?
Well, I'm good. I am good. And yes, we have survived the budget and budget week.
Yeah.
I don't know why people get so exercised about the budget. I really don't. But I've got, I covered 10 commentators just in the weekend papers alone. I thought that was enough of a segment, a sample size, for us to discuss what happened. Who do you want to kick off from first out of that merry band of brothers?
You could cut straight to the chase and go to Stephen Joyce, who always writes like a diamond on glass about these things. You know, as usual, he's just outlines the situation in a way that New Zealand's mainstream media seem incapable or at least reluctant to do. Under Grant Robertson, the government was responsible for a rapidly expanding chunk of the New Zealand economy, which really squeezed the private sector, and household spending grew from around 28% of GDP to a massive 34.5% in just 5 years, which has to be some sort of record, even given the challenges of the pandemic. By comparison, Michael Cullen took 9 years to do something similar. So he's saying the government's showing spending reducing to 31% of the economy in 4 years' time. It's still too high, but it allows small businesses and families to really flourish, but much better. For comparison, it took us 6 years to get it down to under 30% when we were in government, partly because of the Christchurch earthquakes. I think that's something that a lot of people don't confront enough, as the proportion of the GDP that is just money that's taken out of the productive economy and put into public spending, often ineffectually. Yeah, so I mean, he's still saying that some have pointed out the quite historically low budget allowances in the next 2 years and questioned the likelihood of them being achieved. They are low, particularly in comparison with former Minister Robertson's approach, which was to set sizable budget allowances and still blow past them. In each of his last three budgets, he averaged well north of $20 billion in extra spending over the subsequent 4 years, while in this budget, the coalition will add just $7 billion. You know, whenever we're talking about lives being lost, cancer drugs, now that's the other thing he said was pretty face-palming was the cancer drugs.
Yep.
So, yeah. Stephen Joyce, what did you think about?
What I liked the fact, it was, if you're looking for it, it was in the Saturday Herald, and it was Willis's first budget, the hits, the misses, and those tax cuts. And he was critical. He said, if I have one criticism, is that the independent earner tax credit really should be abolished rather than extended, with the savings reinvested in further lifting the bottom tax threshold. As much as possible, tax reduction should relate to the people's actual pay packet, not some esoteric extra credit that only applies to some people. It's not well understood and often not claimed as it should, and it should go. And being sort of self-employed, that's that tax, I'm aware of that tax credit. It's a pain in the ass. He says here, a salient point is that the tax cuts alongside the rest of the budget initiatives won't be inflammatory according to Treasury's calculations. That's because the overall fiscal impulse is negative. That's important, not at least because it puts the ball clearly back in the Reserve Bank Governor's court and when it starts reducing interest rates. And I think it was Fran O'Sullivan also had a read, that was the whole focus of her piece, but it is. She's actually gone and sent a volley across the court now to Adrian Orr. I think Willis has now said, okay, Adrian, this is what I've done. This is what's going across to you. This is the advice from Treasury. Ball's in your court, sunshine, in terms of those interest rates. He hiked them very, very quickly. He's put this massive brake on the economy, and he's very slow to relinquish letting those go. And I think Willis has, by doing this, she's sort of saying to him, no. It's time to actually get things moving again. And I think Joyce is right to point that out. And, yeah, Fran O'Sullivan pointed out exactly the same thing as well. But, of course, as we know, Adrian Orr was one of Squealer's pet appointees. So will he release the trotters enough to drop those interest rates?
Yeah, another hospital pass from Squealer. Those extra terms that those people who were really at the centre of Labor's failures, both Cuddles, Costa, and Adrian Orr we're kind of stuck with them. And there's probably not enough Cuddles Must Go campaigns. But if he's got any ticker, he should resign. The person who's wrecked it's not going to make it better, as Trump said about Biden.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
Well, Stephen Joyce, sorry, just before you carry on, you know, is pointing out that the freeze in science and skills in the budget is a mistake. And I think that comes down to the idea that you've got to paddle hard towards the danger sometimes, you know, that investing in that, although the government can't always do it. I've spoken to people who've got companies that have a heavy R&D spend and they say, oh, well, you know, we would have spent it anyway, but if the government wants to give it to us, yeah, it's nice. And, you know, they like having their photo taken with us.
Mm. Well, the biggest miss, I think, and it's been pretty well covered by a lot of the commentators in the budget, was the big election promise. I mean, the big one was the tax cuts, but the other one they made were these 13 cancer drugs that they were going to look at funding. And, of course, anyone who's suffering from one of those cancers or has a family member with those cancers was sitting there waiting with bated breath, and, of course, nada, crickets, nothing
You don't mess with people in that sort of situation. And, again, it just comes down to the idea, you know, we've got a country run at the moment, for national anyway, within national, by policy wonks rather than politicians, certainly not by leaders. You'd think that someone in those offices would say to them, hey, look, you know, the thing that you really don't want to be seen cutting are the things that most Kiwis are happy to pay tax for. If they can feel that people with severely disabled children are getting the care they need, or with cancer, you know, have got families and children that are going to lose their parents if you don't fund this, most Kiwis are happy with that. And furthermore, you could say, look, you know, we'll do it, but it's going to mean we're going to have to, and they should still do this. Look, okay, we've changed our mind. We're going to fund these cancer drugs, but, you know, we're going to have to abolish the Ministry of Women's Affairs, the Ministry of Pacific Affairs, you know, the government Māori liaison office, and just chop those. And then, if you know, when they get the blowback, say, well, which do you want?
Yeah. Well, there was definitely
Kiwis who are going to die, or do you want a bunch of aspergic women lobbying to get paid?
So there's definitely been, they've realized, I don't know whether this has been reactionary or it was always part of the plan, but there's definitely an awareness that this was a dropped ball from them, because there's now been signals, particularly from Dr. Shane Retty, that there is something coming. And in the, I think, post-budget press conference, there was an indication from both Willis and Luxon that there was sort of something on the horizon with this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. The problem was messing around with, and I think Joyce said this, the problem is that if you mess politically with Pharmac, it opens a bit of a Pandora's box. But sad photos of people dying of cancer in the papers, going to be very corrosive to an already.
So they already started, and you probably didn't see this one, because it was in the Post, so that sort of doesn't quite sort of filter up in your direction. But I saw it, and I haven't been pulling a huge amount out of the Post in recent times, but I pulled this one out. It's called Patients Miss Out on the Life-Extending Drugs in the Budget. So Piers Fuller, based on healthcare, and they covered a story of this young man, Toby Fuller, who's got an aggressive form of blood cancer, and he was hoping the government would announce a significant boost in funding that would allow Pharmac to fund the drugs he needs. Now, the drug that would help him, you and I actually mentioned several weeks ago, because it's the same drug that my father-in-law had been on, and he'd been funding it himself to the tune of tens and tens of thousands of dollars in treatments, because it isn't funded. And it's a drug for multiple myeloma. It's just getting that so many people are going to be left to die or forced to move overseas, he said. The 25-year-old was diagnosed with multiple myeloma 2 years ago, and with a life expectancy of 3 to 4 years, time was not a luxury he could afford. Now, the thing that stood out to me with this, other than the fact that, you know, this is a young man that if he were to get treatment early and effectively, that he could get good quality of life and time, knowing as I do a bit about multiple myeloma, the thing that leaped out was this: the 25-year-old was diagnosed with multiple myeloma. Multiple myeloma traditionally is a blood cancer that is only seen in most often people 70 plus.
Yeah.
It's a geriatric cancer generally. If you're under 70, it's exceptionally bad luck. And I had an immediate family member who was diagnosed at 49. It was very aggressive. That was considered unheard of at that time, 20 years
ago. Health officials baffled.
Well, the question was never asked. A 25-year-old with multiple myeloma?
If you'll bear with me as I pull on my paranoid hat for a second, could it be that they promised that and had some health officials whisper in their ear, hey, we're seeing a lot of very aggressive turbo cancers. You opening the door to this might not just be for the, and I'm sorry, I don't have the number of people affected by this decision not to fund these cancer drugs, but I imagine it's 100 or so, or I mean, that would just be a guess. But yeah, someone may have said, look, you know, it's not just going to be the 100. What happens if we've suddenly got 2,000 and you're on the hook for all of that?
Yeah.
It's a possibility, because it's very difficult to find another explanation for why they'd be that stupid.
Yeah. I'm very much with Malcolm Holland in this. I think that there are a lot of treatments that we're not getting in this country, which are just absolute standard de rigueur in other Western nations. And, you know, the fact that people still believe that we're a first world nation, I think we're not really. Yeah. And to me, this was the big drop ball of the budget, was the not having an allocation for these drugs in the plan. And Tracy Watkins finish out that theme. Her entire editorial was about, essentially, it's not funding the cancer drugs, it's not funding the additional life. What you're doing is stealing memories, and literally stealing life away from these people. With multiple myeloma, it is a cancer that you can get treatment, can provide you some respite for a time and actually give you really good quality of life. And I've now seen that with two people. As I said, I've got a family member I lost and then another one that they're now at the end of life. If you can buy those extra few years, that's golden. That's golden. You know, I mean, for me, that meant that somebody who was so dear to me was able to see me get married.
Yeah, right.
You know, so when you actually put it in those terms, you can understand why these people are upset and angry, because the one thing they don't have is time.
Yeah, and if you've ever had a near-death experience, life's so sweet. It's so sweet. There's that really depressing, but equally life-affirming, those stories where when people jump off the Golden Gate Bridge and a few of them survive and two or one, they say, you know, as soon as I left the rail and began falling, I thought my problems aren't so hard to solve. I really don't want to die. What the hell have I done? Yeah, I guess it's a case of you know, funding it and just bearing in mind how sweet life is and taking back some of our responsibility for our own health, I guess.
Mm. Indeed. Now, in terms of the overall vibe of the budget, Thomas Coughlin, also in the same edition as Stephen Joyce, he referred to the Taxpayer Curious snap poll that was taken after the budget of actually what the people thought out there. And it was actually more positive than I was expecting. It found that 8% of voters thought the budget was very good, followed by 20% who thought it was good. So that's 28% were pretty happy. And then a further 48% that thought it was okay. So by the time you sort of rack all that number up, it was sort of, what's that, 74% that it was, it was all right. A further 17% of voters thought it was bad, and 7% thought it was very bad, which intrigued me. You know, it shows you the two numbers on the extremes, doesn't it? They're almost mirrored, 7% very bad, 8% very good. So I thought that was rather interesting. Further on, he says it showed that 22% of voters thought spending the budget was too high, while 21% of voters thought it was too low. Again, the mirroring of those numbers, leaving a strong 56% of voters saying that it was about right in the Goldilocks zone. So I thought that was rather interesting. So, Willis, I guess, will be buoyed by that, you know, just over half of Kiwis were like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, our focus groups say it's okay, you know, so that's our source of inspiration. Old Fran O'Sullivan. Old Fran. Sometimes she gets it, sometimes she doesn't. You know, just towards the end of her column in Saturday's paper, she said, but one thing is for certain, Luxon should now stop banging on about inherited fiscal cliffs and all Labour's economic sins. Why? Has the $90 billion of extra debt from Squealer gone away, Fran? Has Chris Hipkins' little ratty-eyed face disappeared and stopped talking about what a terrible job they're doing cleaning up his mess? No. So I don't think they're under any responsibility at all to stop talking about what an incompetent bunch of student politicians they were.
Well, and also too, she then continued on to quote Kenny Rogers and The Gambler. I felt with Fran, she just didn't feel that, I think she had a vision in her head that Christopher Luxon was going to be in green tights, and she just sort of felt that Chris and Nikki weren't Robin Hood enough. But it's kind of like, well, after all of Squealer's Robin Hooding over the last, definitely the last three, if not the last 6 years, you know, we've kind of sung that song, as it were.
Yeah, well, I think my impression of Fran is very similar to my impression of Liam Dan. You know, they very much stick within the Overton's window, and they're intelligent enough to assimilate information and then cough it back up. But they're not really bright enough to step out of our context and history and analyze it from that perspective. So the danger is they're reasonably intelligent sounding people just talking us along for the ride. I've got a friend who's, I think I might have mentioned, very astute financially, and he just said he just face-palmed every time he read one of Liam Dan's columns during the Squealer Robertson years, because he just nodded along with every dumb thing he was doing.
What I did love was Chris Hipkins, who they sent out an email for all of those, you know, particularly those ones that dwell across, I think, central city cafe hotspots, who, oh, we don't need tax cuts. Why are they giving us these tax cuts? We don't require it. And that was arrived. The Labour Party sent out an email saying, great, if you don't need it, donate it to us. That will help us get them voted out.
Waiting with bated breath to see how that campaign goes
with
the Chardonnay socialists.
I did actually think never let a good opportunity go to waste. That did make me laugh.
Well, the hilarious thing was the person who said I think it might have been the lovely Heather du Plessis Allen, said it's yet another opportunity for the Labour to signal that they think they can spend people's money better than they can.
Mm. Steve Mihari also had a few things to say as well, which were quite interesting. And the front end of his, that was Sunday Star Times as well, I think, the front end of his column was very much what you've talked to endlessly with Christopher Luxon, and he identified it. You know, it was, the budget was all very feature, 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 and it wasn't a lot heavy on benefit, benefit, benefit.
Or vision. Particularly. Mm. And yeah, you don't think of Christopher Luxon as a visionary leader, do you? He's not that inspiring. I found a lot to agree with in Steve Mihari's column, but he doesn't quite make the jump to, well, what is the vision? And he sort of still is, just has that one foot stuck in, well, the government's got to take money and give it to poor people, I think it was the impression I got. But he said, in the immediate future, those in government need to work out why their popularity has tanked so quickly. My take is that it is because they have failed to paint a big picture. In practical terms, no one knows where we are heading. The Prime Minister would, no doubt, beg to differ. He is constantly on message, telling voters he wants to grow the economy, reduce crime, focus the public server, and get things done. No one can fault his commitment. He gives the appearance of someone who is totally dedicated to the job of turning the country around. But the problem is that he has chosen to do this by running the country in a manner of a modern corporate executive. He thinks that because he talks expansively about the country getting its mojo back, I cringe every time he says that myself, he has told us what his government is all about. The big picture is sorted. Specific policies are what matter. Mm.
The other paragraph for me was, but in a world that is turning its back on globalization in favor of nationalism and national security, do we really think that pursuing the same policies abated with renewed vigor is going to work? And he was referring in terms to free trade agreements offshore. Mm. Now, I agree with him. There's a lot of nationalism going on. But we're 5 million people, Steve.
Well, you know? Yes, but, you know, we've just had, before Luxon, we've just had two prime ministers on the hop, I need to remind everyone, who were World Economic Forum young global leaders. And so they were all about taking down nationalism and in favor of this globalist technocracy. So it's quite something for Steve Mihari to be breaking with that.
Yeah. So, and here's the next thing. So how about jobs? The government believes growth will provide a solution to inequality. It didn't in the past and it won't in the future. The only thing that will seriously reduce inequality is the spread of good jobs throughout all regions and sectors of the labour market. Good job is one that offers reasonable income with some security and savings, relative stability, safe working conditions, and opportunities for career advancement. Nothing the government is doing will increase the number of spread of jobs of these kinds. Hello, that sounds very much like a public sector job to me, just quietly, and they're shedding those. However, in the next paragraph, transport, we do, as the government says, need more roads. But we know that if we build more roads, we will get more traffic, which will lead to further demand for more roads. Knowing this, the future-orientated transport policy will see the merit in the balanced approach of inclusive of roads, rail, cycling, walking, and public transport. Instead of doing this, the government has privileged roads. Now, I have spent in the last month a lot of time on New Zealand's roads. Freaking hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and
hours. What's the Busky report?
And it's really interesting living in a region where you're out on the limb a little bit. And I have spent some time going between Napier and Wairoa four times in the last month. Now, that road, if anybody has travelled that road post, and it was never brilliant prior to Cyclone Gabrielle, it certainly is not a flash post-Cyclone Gabrielle, right. And there's a massive amount of work going on there. Now, there's a lot of people who are doing a lot of important work who, as far as I'm concerned, would fall into the good jobs category, because every single person that's out there is doing some amazing work, right down to the people that are operating all the traffic lights. And believe me, there are a lot of traffic lights on that road right now. And you get a wave and a smile, and they are creating and rebuilding something that is so vitally important to this region. Now, we headed south. I've also, so from Napier down, all the way down to Wellington, up through Palmerston North, I did Transmission Gully for the first time. Wow, that's an engineering feat. That freaking piece of road is beautiful. I can now see where all the money was spent. And the one thing, I had my mother with me the entire time, and the one thing my mother kept saying, bearing in mind she lives in Gisborne, these roads are so lovely. There's no potholes, and there's no and isn't that sad? Because for her, crap roading is the norm.
Yeah. Oh, when you go to Australia, she wouldn't be able to believe her eyes.
I think, what is a good job? I think Steve's idea of a good job and my idea of a good job, I think, are two totally different things.
And again, you've got to sheet that back to the failure of the union-mandated education system to give children a vision of why they need to keep on top of their maths. You know, if we did that 10 years ago, we'd be in a totally different place now. If all of these Māori leaders had been as concerned about the failure of 98% of kids in decile one classes to pass basic reading, writing, and maths tests, we'd be a different country now. You can only twist your hair into pigtails for so long and ask why we haven't got it.
Yep. Is there anything more that you want to cover off? Is there anything glaring that you want to cover off on the budget that we've missed?
I mentioned here the De Pussy Allen.
Oh, yes, actually. Yes, she had some good numbers in there.
I think just pointing out the folly of framing this as tax cuts for the rich, or, you know, borrowing money to give tax cuts. Basically, the tax cuts are well overdue, full stop. We've gone 14 years without our tax brackets being adjusted. National Stephen Joyce had them penciled in, but Labour won the 2017 election and stopped them. She said there was nothing noble about them doing that. It just meant that they raked in more and more tax each year from hardworking Kiwis by stealth. It didn't look like they were taking more because nothing changed. But fiscal drag meant the average income, this is astonishing, went from below $48,000 to $76,000. And because the tax rates didn't change, average wage earners who used to pay a minimum 17.5% in tax were now paying 33% in tax. And yeah, she says Nicola Willis has done right by Kiwis to adjust those, and she actually should have gone further.
Mm. Well, I think what you and I said here the other week, I did some back-of-the-envelope numbers, and if you're on minimum wage working a 40-hour week, you now kiss that 33-cent tax bracket.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Hello? I mean, that's just common sense. I mean, she even said that she believed that Willis didn't go far enough on those. She should have gone further.
Yeah, given the financial trouble Willis keeps telling us we're in, she should have cut government expenditure. Given the wastefulness of Robertson, there should have been plenty to cut. But David Seymour's razor gang only found $1.5 billion in the annual cuts. That's nothing. In a budget that spent $176 billion, that is pocket change. And the media bleating and the Labour loveys, and I'm looking below her at Shane Tupou, you know, really need to be called out on this. And again, you know, we should scrap some government departments, Ministry of Ethnic Affairs, Minister for Pacific Peoples, Ministry for Women. It needs to be paired right back.
Well, Shane said something about that. Nowhere is clearer than in the funding for Māori Development and Pacific Peoples Ministries. More than $100 million has been cut from these budgets over the next 4 years. And to add insult to injury, there's now no new funding allocated to areas at all. These are clearly a blind spot for the government that has no Pacifica representation or vanishingly few Māori MPs. I mean, he's wah-wahing because she's not given them any more
money. Lying,
I mean, what you're saying is that...
Yeah, there are quite a few Māori MPs. They're just not holding out their hats and crying victim. And that's an underrepresented sector of the Māori community anyway, because they don't like to speak badly against their whānau, who are. So they either just shut up and just keep working and smiling, or bugger off to Australia. And a lot of them have taken the second option.
Yeah. He also did a lot of complaining about things, sort of laying things at National Store, which was kind of like, Shane, the fire was kind of set by your lot, sweaty. The number of people without work is due to rocket over the next year, up 47,000 from when National took office. We know that it's Māori, particularly rangatahi Māori, who suffer when jobs become scarce. And as you just said, there are a lot of them with a get up and go going, they're going to Australia. And then he sort of went on to say, this is not a budget that will help lift a generation of Māori affected by COVID. Darling, not just Māori that was affected by COVID, the entire nation was affected by COVID.
Well, they've probably been slower to get back to school. I even took one for the team and read Simon Wilson's from yesterday, his empty budget promises destroying us instead of improving our lives. This was in yesterday's New Zealand Herald. There are little flickers of even Simon Wilson understanding maybe that the squealers' orgy of borrowed money spending hadn't done us much good. Willis' first budget has been called a political success for this exact reason. It managed to lean not too much in any direction. Debt is rising, but not by a lot. There are cuts, but they could be worse. Some frontline services are getting a boost, but others are being cut. No one, we're supposed to think, should be too upset. So again, this speaks to that lack of vision. I think the government really should be providing conduits for ordinary New Zealanders to participate in things while they work, whether it's social investment or environmental things. There's a fair bit of untapped potential energy there that they could get in that ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. And if they could do that, if they could mobilize, because the less government, more freedom types, which, you know, often characterized as right wing, do get a lot more done than the more government, less freedom types, the gimmies. And we really should flex that. And you see that, and we'll get to the Trump verdict on Friday soon.
But yeah, well,
you notice no cities there were getting burned down, but they're ready to go. In fact, should we go there now?
Let's go there now, and then we can transition across to what's going on with Te Pāti Māori, because I think that there are some interesting parallels there. So, the Trump verdict came out. So, as you may have heard before, if you listened to my interview with Trevor, I did actually speak to Trevor it was early Friday morning for me, and we knew they were in deliberation, so we knew it was any time, and Trevor called it. He said, well, he's going to be found guilty. He had no doubt about that, and of course, a matter of hours later, he was. You know that it's bad when you see even leading left-wing commentators who are, you know, sort of saying, yeah, this was not judiciary's finest hour.
Well, it just horrifies me seeing New Zealand media's portrayal of it being in lockstep with the New York Times and the Washington Post and CNN and Rachel Maddow, essentially. I've listened to some excellent commentary on the other side of it from Dan Bongino, Glenn Beck, Mark Levin, really interesting breakdowns just on the absurdity of the charges, having to do some weird acrobatics to overcome the fact that it had exceeded the statute of limitations. And then because it was a misdemeanor rather than a felony, they had to make it about election, to say it was election tampering. And then they blocked Trump bringing his expert in to say why it wasn't. And now they've got a gag order on the man who's leading the race to be elected president of the United States. Unprecedented. Mm-hmm. And then they've got the gall here and overseas to say it's not politically motivated and it's got nothing to do with Biden. Megyn Kelly was really quite a weather vane on this, I thought. She was basically saying, well, the gloves are off now.
Yeah, you know, and, I mean, she's a qualified lawyer, so she's, yeah. You know, she's yeah. been all over this. And the thing is that I mean, I'm pretty ambivalent on Trump, to be brutally honest. So, I mean, you know, people forget that it's a three-horse race. And if I was in the United States, I wouldn't be voting for the two leading horses. I know where I'd be going. However,
I'd probably be going in the same place.
Yeah. However, what concerns me is always that whole saloon door scenario. Because yeah. if they've gone and done this with Trump now, careful what you wish for, because you open the door for that to yeah. swing back and smack you in the face in the other direction. And it just
and there's plenty to go after.
There's
plenty to go after, and they did say in the you know, when Trump was in office, we don't want to be going after our political opponents with lawfare. You know, that's banana republic stuff. And Alan Dershowitz, who's one of America's greatest legal minds, was adamant about that. That the US is very deep in banana republic territory now, and it would be lovely if there was one voice in the media. In the mainstream media, I guess acknowledging what a tremendous break from convention this is, and maybe reframing it, yeah, as a color revolution.
Well, I just said to Trev before, you know, is the reason that they're doing this a distraction? Because I mean, the whole thing is open to appeal. I mean, it's built on the shoddy house of cards, the entire trial. That, of course, it'll be instantly appealed, which will then drag out the process for a whole bunch longer. Is that actually the game? Is that actually what they want? Because by doing that, it keeps the focus on the trial and away from the absolute disaster that Biden is making of everything else that he's involved with at the moment. So by pointing a finger at Trump and just saying, look at this, he's a felon, he's convicted, he's all of these things, that they don't actually see that the dottery old man that doesn't even know what day of the week it is making such a ham-fisted disaster of the war in the Middle East and what's going on in Ukraine,
always,
Russia and everything else.
I'll take it that extra step and say, in a way that probably suits some very, very rich people just fine.
Mm.
It suits some people just fine. And so, yeah, when you see that sort of outrage in the press, it's always worth remembering it suits people who've got the power to change it just fine, that it's just the way it is. Those other commentators, and as I said, I always enjoy Glenn Beck's podcast. I always enjoy Dan Bongino's take on things. Yeah, Alan Dershowitz in terms of the actual nuts and bolts of the legal aspect of it. He was allowed to stay on when the courtroom was cleared, and he said he'd never seen anything like that in a US courtroom before. So it was just appalling.
It'd be interesting to see where they go to from here, and also to follow what the support does, because if they thought it was polarized before, I think it'll make it even more polarized now.
They're not burning cities down.
No.
And that's telling. I mean, you know, he raised in 10 hours something like $36 million, and 30% of that was from people who'd never donated before. His polling went up 6%. Yeah, the danger is, well, you've got these people who've who have done a fair bit that's beyond the pale, who are cornered rats. People saying, well, I think they're going to kill him.
Pretty terrifying, really. Speaking of our own sort of political shenanigans and drama, for once it's not the Greens, which is, you know, a nice change of play. But, of course, we mentioned it last week with the day of activation with Te Pāti Māori, and of the columns that I looked at over the weekend, Sarah Sparks talked about the, was it Te Toi Te Tiriti day of activation? And, I mean, if you were reading her, you would think that it was all sunshines and glitters and Māori rainbows and everything was wonderful and all Māori love everybody and everybody should all loves all Māori and everything is great as long as you believe in Te Tiriti.
Yeah.
If everybody were just to believe in Te Tiriti, that we'd all be tickety boo and kapai.
She's kind of the saccharin to stop you noticing the poison, that woman. And, you know, the interesting thing as well, she mistranslated, I've only got one page of it here, the other one's disappeared somewhere, but Toito Te Tiriti, Te Tiriti, isn't it? She mistranslates it as honour, whereas if you look up the meaning of Toito, it means undisturbed. So it's more like don't mess with the treaty. And as always, and I mean, I looked at Rawiri Waititi's wife, and we've spoken a little about that and her expletive laden rant. And you think, man, you're not 100% well. You're certainly full of hate. And there's that kind of reversal always. So the Toi Te Tiriti, what they're protesting is a politician saying, hey, the treaty has been disturbed. It's been, you know, all of these principles of the treaty that have been added to it and used to give it meaning that it never had at the time it was signed. So really, it's very much the opposite, as Luciferians are very fond of doing. They reverse meaning. And it's the same as Waititi can stand up and talk about this Pākehā government and the Pākehā budget, and in a way that's just dripping with hate. And yet anyone who's arguing against him is racist. They always accuse you of what they're doing themselves. But
well, then that segues really nicely into what I was actually quite amazed to see. It has been a very, very good mainstream legacy piece around the tentacles, because, of course, I think it was Kiri, as you know, Kiri Waititi Tamahere is Rawiri Waititi's wife, but John Tamahere's daughter. So she was part of the activation. But then we have a look at Andrea Vance, who wrote a story around the Manurewa Marae. Now, some of you may remember back at election time that there was a little bit of post-election, a little bit of a furore around that, and both National Labour and Vision New Zealand laid complaints with the Electoral Commission around things that were going on at that marae, because the marae was a polling booth, it was open for early voting, it was perceived as being a breaching electoral law because they were seen to be actively promoting Te Pāti Māori, which makes sense because the marae's then CEO was the candidate for Te Pāti Māori, and her name is, and I've written it
Takutai
down
somewhere. Moana Natasha Kemp.
Natasha Kemp. So she is the candidate, and of course she beat out Penny Hiriri, Labour's incumbent, in the seat by, I think it was 42 votes. So it was as tight as tight could be.
Tight as a match, Chuff Busky.
So Andrea Vance has actually done a deeper dive into this because some whistleblowers have now come out. So the Electoral Commission basically said nothing to see here. No, everything was kosher and it's just fine. Vance has gone and taken a deeper look. Now, I actually had to draw myself a little bit of a Venn diagram because the other person that's done a lot of work on this, and they did work on this all the way back when this Electoral Commission complaint was made, and that was Thomas Cramner, a.k.a. Philip Crump, who had that wonderful blog, and he's now working with NZME. And I know Karina Shields has been running with us in regards to things with the Waipirata Trust. And if you're saying, well, hold on, Marie, you're talking about the Manuri Wamarai, what does that have to do with the Waipirata Trust? This is where the diagram comes in. Talk about a web of connection, and all roads lead back to Tamahere.
Yeah.
All of them. So John Tamahere is the president of Te Pāti Māori. He also happens to be the CEO of the Waipirata Trust. People know that. What they don't realise is he's also the CEO of a company called Te Pou Matakana Limited, which also under its umbrella has an agency called the Te Whānau Ora Commissioning Agency. Well, Te Whānau Ora Commissioning Agency, its sole purpose is to actually apply for grants and subsidies from the government. And from those grants and subsidies that it gets from the government, it then redistributes those funds back into areas to be able to provide services for Māori. And one of the main beneficiaries of those funds is, drumroll please, the Waipirata Trust, which also happens to be a minority shareholder in Te Whānau Ora Commissioning Agency. But wait, there's more. Tamahere's wife, Arawera Rangi Tamahere, she's the chief operating officer of both the commissioning agency and the Waipirata Trust. Kemp was CEO of the Marae. They were also received good chunks of money from Te Whānau Ora, to the point when the accounts were filed just recently in April of 24, and this is what Cramner discovered, for the financial year 2021, I might add, touch behind on the accounting, the funding that they received as an entity is $6,518,008 for DHB and health service contracts.
Yeah.
There's a lot of needles and a lot of
bread. Well, the reason they're behind as well is that I seem to remember from their income over COVID jumped 100% or something.
That was with the Waipirata Trust.
Yeah.
And then throw on top of that, the Waipirata Trust, it was also revealed again by Thomas Cramner that the executives within the trust were paid, by the time you averaged everything out, their salaries were around $400,000 per executive per salary. God, that must have been what Steve Mahari was talking about with good jobs.
Yeah, no, it's there's a bit to run on that. Excellent bit of journalism from Andrea Vance. I was really impressed with that article. It's very, very detailed. But, you know, what I get from these guys is that they've really internalized that Marxist idea that the ends justify the means. I think, you know, that they've been dishonest. And he was absolutely cynical in how, have you got evidence? Well, you know, what's your problem? Just shameless about it all, because he thinks, hey, what's good for me is good for Māori. And any lying, cheating, stealing that they do, allegedly.
Well, the current complaint that Vance is investigating with these whistleblowers is catching every name. Stats New Zealand investigates alleged misuse of Māori census data. So the latest allegation that's unearthing all of this has been, and this is, they've got it, she's, in this, you're right, she's done an excellent piece of journalism. She's spoken to some of these people. She's really dug deep on this. And there are former staff from the Manuri Wamarai who have come forward. And when they were doing the census drive, and I know I've spoken to Karina about this in the past, the census drive, which they were given a chunk of money to get, I think, 10,000 people, Māori, and make sure that they get captured in the census. Now, they called them to get them enrolled, and that what they did is they also did it two things. They did a drive to get them on the census, but also onto the Māori roll as well, because that was going on simultaneously. And they used, essentially, incentives to get these people through, from everything from grocery vouchers to, all sorts of things. I loved one of the terms that they had there, and they were saying how the Māori roll, at these events, people were encouraged to switch the Māori roll and handed a $100 gift card on completing the form. For the Tamaki area, Penny Henry was disadvantaged because he didn't activate the way that Tash Kemp did with the funding that she had, a senior staffer said. Don't you love that twisting of language? Activate. I think in simple terms, that's known as a bribe.
And well, the Electoral Commission that day of activation on Friday as well. They're very carefully chosen words. It's very exothermic in its meaning. It's creating an explosion, essentially. It's not an organic growth. It's activating resentment and bitterness and jealousy.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, resentment, bitterness and jealousy, because they're actually, for me, this is an absolute masterclass in deflection. So they're deflecting that onto the government, onto Pākehā, onto people that they claim have advantage over them. That is critical race theory 101. However, what they're doing is trying to deflect that away from the millions and millions and millions of dollars sucked in by, obviously, Manurewa Marae, the Waipareira Trust, which theirs, I think, went from $8 million to $24 million across that COVID period, $400,000 worth of salaries. John Tamahere is living out in Manurewa or South Auckland in an ex-state house, struggling to put 99-cent noodles on the table. You know, there is a lot of wealth. That's fine. If all that money's gone out to go out to whānau, to go out to the community, what's the trickle-down been? I don't think the trickle-down has been as much as it should be.
Well, also the fact that he's comfortable stirring up such resentment, hate and racism, for me, is the most egregious thing about all this, is the way he's saying things that are designed to justify. And you can go through the paper and there's awful behaviour by young people, bullying, serious assaults, there's gang activity. And a lot of what Te Pāti Māori says seeks to legitimise that as some kind of political protest or somehow justified by some sort of historical utu. Very dangerous territory. And I think, just as the American Republicans aren't burning cities down the way Democrats would have if the boot were on the other foot, I suspect that New Zealanders are getting quietly, increasingly determined to address what's going on. I think you're probably beating a dead horse expecting National to come up suddenly with a visionary way of thinking, but I think New Zealanders should probably go through the door that's open a crack with social bonds and social investments, get together and defy these people by finding things that Māori and Pākehā can work on together to improve those things that Māori leadership should have been more focused on over the past 30 years, education, the environment in a meaningful way.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you're one of those allies that think that, no, they need the support, we need to go out there to support all of these people in our days of activation. No, actually, what you need to do is you need to zoom out and you need to see what are the motivations behind the people that have actually called for this activation. I think you'll find that they're not as squeaky clean as they appear to be.
That's, well, it's interesting, you know, and you've got to commend all the Māori who went to work on King's birthday in defiance of having a holiday in his honour.
You know, with all those penal rates and everything else that they just
said. Anything else? I've got one more thing that I thought I'd like to comment on.
Yeah, go on.
An article in the Sunday Star Times on page 8, Survivors Hope for Bold Overhaul, which was about recommendations of the Royal Commission into Abuse in Care. Now, I think this is really, really relevant, because if we're going to fix things up, we have to get back to a situation where we can trust institutions to take care of vulnerable children, take care of vulnerable people generally, because the situation where you had people who maybe were drawn to working with vulnerable children weren't the right people to be doing it, or were doing it for the wrong reasons. And that kind of put us off having those sort of institutions, hospitals for people with severe mental illness. And that, I guess, reached its zenith when Helen Clark closed down all of the mental institutions generally. And I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but my first year at university, I didn't get into the halls of residence, but my mother did find a hostel nearby which was quite cheap and quite near the university. So they drove me there, and there were sort of quite odd people shuffling around, and I felt a bit, I was only 17, and it turned out that it was a halfway house for Tokonui patients that had been inundated with people who'd been just let out of these institutions, and a lot of them were insane and really would have been better in a in an institution. But the reason I singled out this this article was there were some real elements of hope in it, and you've got to really feel for people who got caught in this, and the government, both National and Labor, have been very slow to acknowledge the extent of abuse that occurred, much less apologize for it, much less pay compensation to those whose lives were often severely affected. But there was one man called Jim Goodwin, who was someone who'd survived this. He said some really interesting things, I thought. So Jim Goodwin, a survivor of abuse in faith-based care, says the Royal Commission's process has been impressive. I'm really impressed with the number of amazing people that have been working so hard to run the commission, to be on the commission, the people who have made statements, survivors, survivor support people. There has been a whole lot of amazing people working really hard for long years to make this thing work. So that's a real bit of hope. Williams adds, the commission managed to gain the trust of many survivors to come forward and tell their stories. And he's quoted as saying, no mean feat, given survivors have a learned distrust of formal systems and authority. I think there's some really hopeful stuff in there. He says, Williams' expectation is that the recommendations will include a vision of hope for the future. The future I envisage is a sophisticated democracy that phases out care and enables people to have resources and support to live in an abuse-intolerant world. Goodwin says, even after taking part in the Royal Commission process for years, he is still shocked at the astronomical scale of abuse that had occurred in the state and faith-based care. And people knew it was sort of little pockets. It has never all been collected together, but people did know. And he talks also about how he'd hoped to meet with his abusers in a restorative justice meeting to tell them how the abuse had affected his life, but they refused and lawyered up. I was a bit disappointed, but unsurprised. It is what it is.
What was the timeline on that? Just out of interest.
It didn't really. The Royal Commission was established in 2018 to investigate the abuse of children and adults in state and faith-based care from 1950 to 1999.
Wow.
So we're not talking about something that's really in the distant past. There are people still alive who perpetrated the abuse, and there are people still living with its effects. So, yeah, those areas are the places that we've got to keep mopping up. You know, waste less time looking for racism where it doesn't exist, and really look to the people who are genuinely suffering and still suffering from that kind of.
And it also goes to what you've said often, that when we're in, particularly those of us in the freedom movement and with what's going on with COVID, that it's a marathon, not a sprint. And that's what this shows us, is that when it comes to answers with what's gone on in the last 4 years, it may not happen in the next few years. It may not happen with the inquiry with this government, but it will happen.
And I'm my favourite saying that I wish I'd known when I was a child: people overestimate what they can do in the short term and underestimate what they can do in the long term.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Hey, before we go, I've got a little bit of feedback.
Oh.
And I'm going to do this because the lovely Liz has just sent it through. It's because it's from Mike from Foxton.
Oh, good old Mike.
Yeah, we love the Mike.
Hey, Mike, you know, I'll say this before Marie gets started, assuming that this isn't a nasty email.
It was from Mike. So yeah, it's never asked me.
But yeah, thanks for all your letters. I know that maybe sometimes you thought, oh, well, you know, I'm always writing them, but we appreciate every one of them because, you know, starting something like this, yeah, any encouragement you get when you feel sometimes that you're speaking into a void is so encouraging. So it really helped us keep going. So thanks, Mike.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, we do. We love the Mike. So from Mike, oh my God, you two, you should both be in government running the country. No, Mike. No, Mike, no. We love our sanity. We'd much rather send off pot shots from the sidelines. I can't believe we have such extraordinary talent as hosts on a radio station. Your balanced and insightful comments on media matters is very inspiring. Makes me think even more about the goings on in mainstream media. Where would we be without RCR? Just keep on doing what you're doing. It works. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I think for many decades, successive governments have tried to fix things that weren't broken, e.g. education and the likes. And I believe that we were in the top three for education in the world for many years. And then they came along and fixed it. Look at the result of what fixing the education system did. Our society is paying the price, and so are we. That's you two rock from Mike. Well, you rock too, Mike. We love hearing from
Thanks,
you.
Mike. Have a great day.
Yes, thank you for that. And yeah, I'm just looking at time. We need to get going, my friend.
All right. Well, thanks for a great chat, Maria.
No, it's been great. We'll do it all again.
Your June is a bit less high pressure than your May's been. You've been under the pump, haven't you? Poor old thing.
Just a touch. And a big thank you, to Marty, who stepped in for me for Fourth Estate last week because I have been under the pump. So I'm back this Friday. But Marty, did a great job. And if you haven't heard it with Marty, Peter Williams, and Judge Harvey, that's actually up now on the replays on the RCR.
Yeah, great privilege to talk to two such learned gentlemen.
Yeah, they were awesome. And it was awesome. I enjoyed it. I listened to it last night. It was amazing. So do make sure you check that out. And of course, if you want to send us some feedback, 2057 is the text and inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email. All right. Thank you, Marty. We'll do it all again next week.
Thanks very much. People, keep listening, keep sharing. And if you're not in this Foundation Members Club, if you're not a member of the Foundation Members Club, do sign up. And there's going to be more and more coming through that while still maintaining the great free content.
And on that note, we'll see you all next week.
Have a great week.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.